出来了。Typically, now, typically we're not going to have announcements during class time. We will have them at just before class. That way we'll get the full class time, and if you're here a few minutes early, you'll get to hear the announcement. But today, I do want to have the announcements right now, because there are a bunch of things that people ought to know about that have pertained to this term, for example. So I'm going to make an announcement, and then I'm going to ask the people who have announcements to make brief announcements. My first announcement is, if possible, get here at 10:10, because that's when the class is really going to start, because that's when we're going to ring the bell for the announcement. Okay? So get here a little early if you can. First announcement I have is Michael Gilsworth, who came and talked about evolutionary psychology, has a new section of that class that starts next Tuesday. That's next Tuesday evening. He left flyers on the table for you. And he's going to talk in more sophisticated fashion about the current understanding of evolutionary psychology and how we see it in our daily lives. So who else has announcements right now? Okay, so Chris and Lau.
In a group I belong to, and several people here, Word and Life, we are studying a book. We have speakers every week. It's called The Book of Forgiving by Desmond Tutu.
Can you use this?
We're studying. Is it working?
It's fine. Just for about 2 minutes.
Okay. The Book of Forgiving by Desmond Tutu. It's a fourfold step program on forgiveness, and we started a worldwide movement. The cost of forgiveness. And we are having Matthew Fox next week as the speaker. And he just came out with a book on Meister Eckhart, and he was signed books at Chaucer's the day before. So Thursday, September 18th, from 10 to 12 at Word and Life, and there are flyers over there. It's, I think it's which church is it? Presbyterian Church on Constance. So and look at the other speakers, they're all professionals, very good speakers. We have an imam coming, Rahul Weiner from psychiatrist, and anyway, look at the list, excellent speakers, excellent program.
And there are flyers, thanks Chris.
Flyers on the table.
Now, with regard to the fans, if possible, I would like them not to be on, because I don't want to have to yell and they create background noise. So turn them off, and if we need them, we'll turn them back on. It's going to be hard. I can't, when I lead the meditation, I can't lead it with a microphone. And I can't yell either because I'm meditating. Okay. Who's next announcement? Okay, let's see. Well, here and then here. 2 inches. Can you hear that now?
Yeah.
2 inches.
Hi, I'm Christina Kramer, and I am offering an 8-week series on the energy field and the chakra system. It's based on my 4 years of training with Barbara Brennan, who wrote the book Hands of Light. And in these 8 weeks, I give a very thorough understanding of the energy field, all the layers of the auric field, and over each layer of the field, and all of the chakras. And then I teach you how to open and clear your chakras, how to clear energy that you pick up from other people or different environments that you're in, how to feel into the different levels of the field. We work with clairvoyance, which is seeing, clairaudience, which is hearing, clairsentience, which is seeing, claircognizance, which is direct knowing. And I teach many, many energy healing techniques that really make a difference in how you feel physically and emotionally. So I don't think there are any flyers left, but if you're interested, I can leave you my phone number, and I'll bring more flyers next week. It's 805-680-5623. Thank you.
Thank you. It's Abraham.
And you can probably just do it without this, right?
Okay.
Well,
for the last 30 years, I've been working on the theory and the information about this book, Who Created the Universe and Why. And in the last 2 years, I got serious about it and started writing something, and I tossed it around everywhere. Carl helped me a little bit with editing and some other friends. I asked Spencer, but he says he was busy. But anyway, I was pleased with it, and I sent it out to the printer, and that's what they got this week. So it's $17. I really answered the question. I'm not kidding. It's $17, but every time I sell a copy, I'm going to contribute $2 to CLL. So I don't have anything to say about it. The book speaks for itself. It's very simple.
Can you read the story today?
Well, you know, I don't know.
No, we'll have to talk about that.
Yeah,
we'll talk about it. Good job.
Thank you.
Okay, so let me see. Okay, again, we have to make this brief because we have class, folks. Okay, so I have three different analogies here. Alain, and then Carl, and then Michael, and me.
I wonder if
Abraham
could just read the answer.
Sometimes. All right, Carl.
I have a quote.
Okay, come on, we got to move this, folks. We got a whole long class. So come
on. I have a few copies of an informal flyer over there. But starting in early October, I have a CLL class that meets for four times the initial startup for the class. It's called Advances in Biology, Prospects for a Longer, Healthy Life. And there's been a number of big headlines in this area of cell biology and medicine just in the last couple of weeks. My wife and I went to a conference in Northern California a couple of weeks ago, brought people from all over the world. Anyway, cell biology, in terms of our physical nature, it's going to change the way medicine and health and the diagnosis goes. So it'll be 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday, starting October 14th and ending November 4th. And you can sign up for it at CLL if you want to join us for discussion. So this is the physical side of our self, and the psychological, as opposed to the spiritual side of the development.
So this is really exciting that Carl is doing this. I'm very, I recommend this highly.
Okay. And I'm not a biologist, but we're using the lectures by the best minds and most up-to-date material in the world. So,
what's the title of the class that we're looking
for? Advances in Biology. It's under health. Advances in Biology, Prospects for a Longer, Healthy Life. And these people are top of the world expertise. You just read the flyers. I don't have time to read it here, but they don't. This is a new world.
Is it here?
Yeah. It'll be at Wake Center, room 15.
Thank you, Carl. Okay, so let's see, Michael, and then I have an announcement, and then we go.
I put together a collection of about 10 mind superminds, all the ones that I audio recorded from 2010 through the last one with Rupert Sheldrake last night. I put them all together on a single CD. There are a couple copies. I give one from the internet, and then we can bring back to the class.
Right.
And they're MP3 files.
Okay, so no, just the first hands you see, give them out.
Okay.
Go give them out.
And this Donna is wants one to have and circulate
one people in the know. Class. Also,
I'm gonna announce.
This is not. This is for you speaking. This is just his talk. I thought you might want that.
The Richard. No, I don't want it.
Okay.
I want it eventually, but you can give. That's a Rupert Sheldrake talk. Who wants first? Okay. Okay. Good. The Rupert Sheldrake talk was video. Thank you, Michael. The Rupert Sheldrake talk was videoed, and it should be on the CLL website. Really quickly. So if you weren't there or want to see it again, you can see it. Announcement. Let's see. William Peters, who has come to the class three times, he's the one who works with near-death experience and shared death experience. And there's many people in this class have taken classes from him. He has two new classes. The flyers are on the table. And he said, if money's a problem, he'll work with you. Okay. So if you're interested in the shared death experience or near-death experience or helping people with the dying process, then William's the go-to guy in Santa Barbara. Or any go-to guy, anyway. All right, so typically announcements are going to happen, again, from 10:10 to 10:15, not during class time. So let us commence. I don't know, Julie. I'll have to
work it out.
Okay. So, if you didn't sign in and are registered when you leave on the table, check 9:12 next to your name. If you registered after last night at 5 p.m., your name isn't on the list. Write your name, check 9:12. If you didn't register, register. Okay. This is a new. Almost all of you, think you know why you're here, but this is the new course description. Okay?
I wouldn't be here.
All right. So it's not greatly changed from the old one, okay? But this is going to be in the winter schedule. Okay. This ongoing class is about becoming more aware of what's within and around us. Inside, look around. We begin each session with mindfulness, instruction, and practice, and then turn our attention to the newest developments in psychology and the social sciences, the physical sciences, the arts, world culture, and spirituality. Guest speakers and internet resources are integral to our explorations. Our goal is to evolve personally and to meaningfully contribute to humanity's evolution. So that's the same as it has been, just nicer words. Not six verbs at the end. Okay. All right. A few procedural things, and then we'll go into the lessons. Flyers will always be on the table. So if you have flyers that are relevant for the class, you can put them on the table. Every time you come to class, check your name off, please. Past classes. Want to hear a class again, or want to see what past classes have been all about, they're all on SWT, right there, SWT.org/Spencer. Thanks to Michael and Robert. Okay. So this is where you go to find our classes, SWT.org/Spencer. All right, we have a dilemma about the art. Here's the dilemma. They have a dance class in here before us. They have to set up all these chairs, and then they have to break them down afterward. So we have this space from 10:15 to 11:45. Now, we can come a little bit earlier so we can do our announcements before class, but we probably can't stay later. So what that means for artwork, which I really want to have come into class, is bring it and put it around before class, and people can look at it before class. But we probably can't do it in class. If that changes, I'll let you know. But please do bring in your artwork, and people will see it. There are a lot of people that will see it because they come a little bit early. If we can do it after class, I'll let you know. Life stories. Donna, what are we doing with life stories?
That booklet is available. It's just one or two page summaries or an anecdote from someone's life. People in the class will contribute them over the time. And so it's available to borrow and bring back. The files are also on the website.
Ah.
So, yeah.
They're also there.
Well, as of some months ago, I don't know if you've seen it.
So you can be famous. You can be on the web. You just make two copies? Is that what we have? Make two copies of a synopsis of your life or an incident from your life? Anything you want to share with folks? We'll put them in the book. We'll put them on the website. It'd be nice if everybody's voice were represented in this collection. Last announcement I have to make. We have three of our eight sessions this term have guest speakers coming. And I'm very pleased about all three, so I'll tell you super briefly about all three. In 2 weeks, Drs. Bonnie and David Paul are coming. They teach at University of Santa Monica in the Spiritual Psychology Program, and they have been running a program in the prisons called Freedom to Choose. I believe the website is freedomtochoosefoundation.org. A really remarkable program that's gotten a lot of notice. And they're going to come and talk to us about the work they do in the prisons and also how relevant it is for all of us. So that they're coming in 2 weeks.
What date is that?
That's on the 26th. They're really something. We're going to be looking a bunch at new developments in neuroscience. And some of those new developments in neuroscience have made their way already into clinical practice. I went to a grand rounds, which is a talk at Cottage Hospital that the public is invited to, where very interesting speakers talk about leading edge things. And the talk was titled, Slowing, Preventing or Reversing Age-Related Cognitive Decline and Dementia.
What's
that? Losing your mind when you get older. I don't know, I can't remember what it means. And the speaker was Dr. Dan Staso, who's a psychologist in Santa Barbara, who for many years has been interested in this and has very leading-edge clinical tools that he uses in his practice. And the talk was very focused and filled with information. So the day after, I called him up and said, would you come to class and give that talk? And he's going to come on October 3rd. It's really full. That's really something. He's got a great PowerPoint. He just leads you through tons of information. And then I thought I wanted to do something on psychotherapy. I thought I wanted kind of the best therapist that I know. And two of the recent speakers at Grand Rounds have been Nancy Gunsberg, who's at LCSW, and Dr. Michael Geis, who's a local psychiatrist, both of whom for many years have been doing nothing but psychotherapy and are really state-of-the-art, I think. And so what I asked them to do is come and not make a presentation. Just sit in the front of the class with me and let you ask them questions about psychotherapy, personal growth, and whatever else that you want to ask them. So they're going to come together on the 24th of October. So those are the three guest speaker sessions we have.
Spencer, are you mentioning the Rehab Institute, inviting the neuroscientists and all the brain experts, the people who had brain damage?
I haven't mentioned that. When is that happening?
Next week, okay, September 22, at Fest Partners.
September 22nd. You'll actually see the ad in the Independent. I think, for something the Rehab Institute is doing. I kind of don't want to... there's a huge amount of interest in what neuroscience is giving us, and we're going to look at that a bunch. Okay, now we're going to... Oh, thank you. What Chris just said is if you want to sell an iPhone 5S cheap, plenty of people... Never mind. please turn your cell phones off. Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to talk a little about mindfulness. And then I'm going to leave. In the first session, rather than just, we always sit for 10 minutes at the beginning of class. But in the first session, I think I'm going to lead you a little bit to tune your meditation. Okay. But before I do that, I want to go to both boards and tell you a couple of things.
Okay, let's see.
First, a new diagram, just because you got totally burned out of the old one. So mindfulness is self-awareness without self-absorption. The usual way that we walk around is lost in ourselves, at least to some extent. As Spencer Tracy said when he was asked about what it takes to be a good actor, remember your lines and don't bump into the furniture. We generally are good actors. We remember our lines and we don't bump into the furniture. But we mostly are in our own inner world. Our thoughts and our feelings are most compelling to us. And we relate to other people and the world through the filter of these thoughts and feelings. That's okay when it's a white fluffy cloud and everything can get through. But when it's a really dark cloud, then we're trapped inside ourselves. So what mindfulness is taking a step back out of that cloud in ways that many of you know how to do, but I will instruct you to do. So you take a step back, and you can see yourself. You can notice your thoughts, your feelings, and your sensations without being absorbed in them. They're just something that you notice. You are free of them. And you can look beyond them to make direct contact with the world and other people. So this versus this. How do you do this? That's what we're going to talk about in a minute. But we'll talk about that in a minute. In mindfulness, you make two choices that you don't usually make. Choice one, you choose to be as open as you can on every level. Typically, we walk around with levels of self-protection, so we're not entirely open, and there's sometimes good reason for that. But when you sit, you surrender. And you open up as best you can in every way that you can. The remarkable results that we hear about over and over again about how important mindfulness is for stress reduction and physical healing pretty much all have to do with the allowing of the openness, the letting go of the tension and contraction, which restore immune function and allow healing and growth. So the first choice you make when you're mindful is to release, soften, open. And if you do nothing else when you sit, at every level that you're aware of, let the limits recede. The second choice we make when we're mindful, the choice to be aware of whatever is happening. Typically, we're lost in thought and unaware of feelings and dimly aware of sensations. When you're mindful, even though you're relaxing completely, you're taking tension and converting it to attention. So you become more and more precisely aware. It's not that you don't have thoughts or feelings or sensations. It's that you have thoughts, feelings, and sensations in a much more clear way. It's just that they don't rule you. So while you're releasing completely, the only effort you make is the effort to stay aware and become more and more clear about awareness, or have a more and more complete awareness. And that awareness is behind all the psychological benefits that we hear about that mindfulness brings. I'm waiting until things quiet down. One last thing, and then we will practice, because otherwise We're lost in fancy thoughts about mindfulness, and we haven't practiced mindfulness. By the way, that's the of all the traps, that's the major trap. Thinking that you're mindful. That's just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic in here. Enlightenment. I consider each time I sit, whether it be 5 minutes or a long sitting, I consider each time I sit to be an enlightenment. And it's the enlightenment that I'm ready for at that moment. Sometimes it isn't very light. Sometimes all I'm aware of when I sit is how miserable I am, you know? That's kind of enlightenment about my enlightenment. But nevertheless, what I consider to be enlightenment is whatever happens, whatever I experience during my mindfulness sessions. So, before the sitting, here's my level of enlightenment, of light versus darkness. Here's my level of openness versus closedness. During the sitting, it usually improves. It may not improve stellarly, but at least I'm more aware, more open than I normally am. And then, of course, I get up from the sitting and regress. But each sitting, you don't regress quite as far as you started. There's an incremental gain from having practiced being more open and more aware. So over time, what happens is the baseline rises. So you start from here as opposed to from here. But that's on average. There are days when you start from here and you think, oh my God, I'm worse than I've ever been. And what you do with that is you step behind it and you notice how difficult your thoughts, feelings, and sensations are at this moment. This is always enlightened. This may be more or less light or dark. So it's not a question of having wonderful experiences and feeling like this is enlightenment. What it's a question of is being clear about what's happening and not being identified with it. So if there's misery, it's just a horror show. It's not me. So how do you do this? How do you take one step back? You do it in two ways. First, I call it softening and opening. You soften and open and soften and open and soften and open. And the second thing you do is you pay attention to your breathing. Why do you do that? Because if you pay attention to your breathing and you start to get lost in thought, you go up and you pay attention to your breathing again, and then you start to get lost in thought. And you see what's happening? Every time I get lost in thought, I get sucked back into the cloud. Every time I pay attention to my breathing, it brings me out of the cloud. So that's a review for most of you of stuff you already know. Now let's practice. By the way, this is usually the first 10 minutes of class or 15 minutes of class. We have other stuff to do, and we're going to do other stuff today. Without this understanding, the other stuff that we do is peripheral. So that's why today I'm emphasizing. Recently, I have been combining physical relaxation with the mindfulness. As those of you who know that when Jon Kabat-Zinn teaches mindfulness, he has you go through the body for 45 minutes in a body scan before you just purely sit. We're not going to do 45 minutes in a body scan, but I'm going to lead you through about 5 or 7 minutes of relaxing each part of the body in turn. Now, I'm not going to go through it ad nauseum. Relax your little finger, relax your next finger. I'm going to just do it in 4 chunks. So it's very easy, it's very user-friendly to do. And your job is just simply to listen to my voice and allow the softening and opening to happen. And then after we do that, I'll give you 5 minutes to keep returning to your breathing, keep allowing more and more openness to happen. If it wants to happen, you can't make it happen, you just invite it. And notice whatever else is happening. If there are worries, you notice the worries. If there is heartbreak, you notice the heartbreak. If there's inspiration, you notice the inspiration. If there's pain, you notice the pain. If there's tickle, you notice the tickle. If there's sound, you notice the sound. So in that last 5 minutes, you just breathe and open. It's as though you're not even there. There's no physical body left. There's just a field of awareness which has no boundary and is centered at the level of your, not at the level, centered at your breathing. There's a breathing in the middle, and there's an infinite field of awareness in which thoughts parade, feelings parade, sensations move through. So you're just awareness and breathing, and everything else is just whatever it is. Simple. Very simple. All right, let's do it.
I guess I should sit.
So first of all, if now that you're going to be sitting, you need to be upright but not rigid, as comfortable as you can be. Put both feet on the floor. It's best rather than have one leg crossed over the other. If your shoes are pinching your feet, loosen them or take them off. Otherwise, your attention will constantly go down to your feet. If you can't breathe, loosen your clothing so that you can. Now, if you don't want to have your eyes closed, you can look down with your eyes open. Really doesn't matter. I generally recommend eyes closed to begin with, but it's up to you. By the way, if for any reason you don't want to pay attention to your breathing, you don't have to. Just pay attention to the feeling of sitting. But for most of us, the breathing is a very good focus. Because we don't make it happen, it just happens. And it's central. Now, breathing is a complex process, involves much of the body if you really pay attention. For many of us, the belly rising and falling is a really good part of the breathing process to focus on. Because it's the most pronounced thing we notice. So if you want, focus on your belly rising and falling. If not, focus on some other part of the breathing process or the whole breathing process. And if not, just focus on sitting. How it feels to be sitting. And as you focus on your breathing or sitting or both, or anything else you wish, you relax. Tension releases itself. You soften and open. Don't try to change your breathing. It will adjust itself. It will soften by itself. It will deepen by itself. Just allow the softening and opening to happen. It's as though you're becoming hollow. It's almost as though you're becoming not even there. And there's simply breathing and awareness. Pay special attention now to your head and your face. If you're holding an expression on your face, as we typically do, let that expression soften.
so that your face smooths out. Your eyes are not held closed tightly, they're just gently closed. And you can feel the relief in all the little muscles around your eyes as you let them soften. Your mouth is not held tightly closed. It's just either gently closed or may even be slightly open. So your face is softening. It's almost as though it's disappearing. It's almost as though it's not even there. Similarly, the sides of your head, the back of your head, and the top of your head are softening and opening. Any tension is dissolving away. And it's almost as though your head is disappearing. And there is spaciousness where there used to be solidity. And, of course, you are breathing. You can feel your gentle breathing. And allow the breathing to soothe you and to open you. Pay special attention now to your neck and shoulders, arms and hands. Your neck and shoulders and arms and hands are softening and opening. If there's tension in your neck and shoulders and arms and hands, see if you can allow that tension to release itself. It's almost as though your neck and shoulders and arms and hands are disappearing. They're becoming so relaxed, so open. It's almost like they're not even there. And there is empty space where there used to be solidity. And of course, you can feel your gentle breathing. It is just soothing you and becoming slower and deeper. Pay special attention now to your torso, your upper back, mid back and lower back, sides of your body, and the front of your body, your chest and your abdomen, and the internal organs of your torso also. Let all those structures, all that solidity, soften and open. So that any tension is let go of and can dissolve away. It's almost as though your torso is disappearing. Your back and sides and the front of your body and the internal organs becoming so soft and open. It's almost as though they're not even there. It's as though a breeze could blow right through where your torso used to be. And of course, you can feel your gentle breathing. Just happening naturally, soothing, relaxing, and opening you. Pay special attention now to your lower body, your lower back, pelvis, legs and feet. Allow your lower back, pelvis, legs and feet to soften and open. Let any tension in your lower body release itself. It's almost as though your lower body is disappearing and there's just empty space where there used to be solidity. It's as though a breeze could blow right through where your lower body used to be. And of course, you can feel your gentle breathing happening softly and rhythmically. Allow your body to continue to soften and open. And similarly, allow your awareness to soften and open, so that you're aware of your breathing, any sensations coming from within your body or from your sense organs, any feelings in your heart, abdomen, or throughout your body, and any thoughts in your head, verbal or visual. As you breathe and continue to soften and open, you let whatever you're experiencing, sounds or anything else, move through you without resistance. You just notice what there is to notice. At the same time, continuing to soften and open. You won't hear my voice for several minutes now, so that you can practice breathing, softening and opening, and being aware of whatever is happening. Let everything be just as it is. Simply breathe and open and notice without becoming absorbed. If you're lost in thought, come back to your breathing and to open awareness. Do not judge yourself for what you just experienced. This is a learning process. There is no perfection, as far as I know, in this process. And each time you practice this, you become a little bit better at it. So even if you found your breathing for about 1 second and the rest of the time you were totally preoccupied, then for 1 second you were mindful. As time goes on, 1 second occasionally becomes two. If you want to practice this on your own, I would suggest starting with 5 minutes. Don't make this a big chore, because if you do, you'll not do it. This is mental hygiene. And it's like brushing your teeth. You don't have to do it too much, just do it on a regular basis. If you would like to be led through this just as you were, you go to drspencersherman.com or spencersherman.com, drspencersherman.com or spencersherman.com. Up comes the front page. Click on Listen. And then there are two audio programs. Click on the top one, and with music, beautiful music from a guy in England, you get led through this process. All right, so Abraham.
You just answered my question, because I was trying to ask you to do the recording. But you just told us. It was so soothing. And with music, probably it's even more powerful.
It's lovely with the music, but also I think Michael's recording this, and we could probably, you probably could get the recording of today. Today was very nice. All right, so I know there are a lot of questions about mindfulness. We'll take them week by week. I think I want to move into the didactic lesson for today. Okay.
Does it have a period after doctor?
No, it doesn't have a period. Just drspencersherman.com. Or spencersherman.com takes you to the same place. OMG. It says here what I'm doing next. I just follow the program. It says, unifying mindfulness and psychotherapy. So I will unify mindfulness and psychotherapy in 10 minutes or less. As I understand it, in the early 1970s, two young guys came back from Southeast Asia and seeded what has become the mindfulness movement in the United States. They were Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield.
And they established the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And for a while they taught together, and then they parted ways, I think amiably, but philosophically they parted ways. And here's why they parted ways. Joseph taught at that time and continues to teach that the way to deal with psychological difficulty is the traditional Eastern way. If you're here, what you do is you go here and you kind of back away from this. It's not that you fix your personality, it's that your personality becomes less what you are and less what governs you. So you step back and back and back until personality is very small in you. And open awareness, original mind in Zen, essence, your divine nature, whatever you want to call it, is where you live, what you live from. That's the Eastern way, the way of letting go of ego, of sense of self. Instead of trying to fix anything, it just becomes irrelevant. What your neuroses are, or worse, become irrelevant. In the traditional Eastern teachings, they don't have a DSM. They don't have words for all this stuff. It's just stuff to be disidentified from. As Jon Kabat-Zinn says, I don't care what you experience when you sit. I don't care if you see God or if you burn to death. Your job is to disidentify from your experience and identify with the experience or not the experience. That I believed that for the longest time until it didn't work. I was good. I sat really well, you know. And I never kind of got rid of ego. And what I realized is what Jack realized, which is that for Eastern people who are already collective and have much less of a developed sense of individuality, it's easier to let go of individuality because it's not the defining characteristic of who you are. And I still believe that Joe is right. If I had 100,000 lifetimes, I would increasingly step back from me, and after a while, me would not be there. All my karma would dissolve. But I don't have 100,000 lifetimes. Well, I'm not aware that I do. So the Western approach, which Jack became a clinical psychologist, as many of you know, and founded Spirit Rock in Northern California. The Western approach is that instead of trying to get to disidentify from ego completely, what you do is you develop ego in a healthy way. That is, instead you heal the ego, heal the difficulties, so that the functional ego, the healthy ego, is less self-concerned. It kind of becomes less important because when you're not okay, you focus entirely on yourself. You know, the worse you are, the more you're self-focused, the less you can interact with other people. You know, you dig your own grave. When you're miserable, then you make yourself more miserable by disconnecting yourself. But as you become healthier, you spend less time worried about yourself. You spend more time interacting with other people, going into flow, dealing with stuff in the world. Because you don't have to worry about yourself. That's what Maslow said. He said self-actualizing people, the people with the healthiest egos, spend the most time focused on other people and the least time focused on themselves. So the path from the Western point of view is you go from unhealthy self to healthy self to an expanded way of living, which includes selfing, but isn't entirely about selfing. Now there's in going from unhealthy ego to healthy ego to an expanded sense of being or an expanded sense of self, there is a problem. The way that Jack puts it is it's really hard to fly with chains on your ankles. Okay? And that's what psychotherapy does, is it unlocks the chains on your ankles. Right? So the marriage of mindfulness and psychotherapy is you sit, you breathe, you notice, you open, you disidentify, you feel better, you feel more expanded, you're more creative, you have more insight. But you know, there are things that you notice in that cloud of thought, feeling, and sensation of self. There are things that you notice that don't go away. Over and over and over and over and over again, those things come. And when I sit, I don't care. I don't care how crazy I am, you know. I sit, and when I'm sitting, I'm free of that. But then I get up, and I go back into that stuff, and it's there again. And it gets to be a drag after the decades. So that's the point at which you say, maybe I need a little help with this. Maybe I need to see what I can do about this stuff so that it doesn't get in, you know, all the time be a factor in my life, and when I'm sitting, cloud my view. So, why is it that we have some of these continuing difficulties, the continuing darknesses, the continuing storms? Because basic needs that we have are not being met. What's the most basic need we have? The need to survive. Out of that, everything else comes. But one level up from that, I think there are four basic needs that I have mentioned before, and I will mention very briefly again. And those four basic needs, when they're met, don't get in your way when you're living and when you're meditating. But when those basic needs are not, when any one of or several of those are not being met, that's what will come up in the meditation. That's what will be driving the difficulties that you become aware of. So what are the four basic needs? They are the first four levels of the Hindu chakra system. That many of us have done the chakragram. We kind of know about that. By the way, if you want to do the chakragram again, I put it on my website. It's on the same website. You just go, it says, leads you through the chakragram. If you haven't done it, you could just get led through it by reading that little article. It's really something. It really makes clear who you are and why. Anyway, the four basic needs. Oh, also, these three of these are the first four levels of Maslow's hierarchy of motives. Remember, he has a five-level hierarchy of motives. The highest one is self-actualization. The other ones are your deficiency needs. So he mentioned three out of four. He missed one, which I thought was interesting. Anyway, here are the four. The most basic need is the need to be healthy and safe. And if you're not healthy and safe, you can be sure when you're walking around or when you're meditating, you're going to be preoccupied by the fact that you're not healthy or safe. That's where your attention is going to go. And what you have to do if you don't want to be preoccupied by that and crippled by that is you have to improve your health as you can and find safety. And you may need help doing that. So the most basic need is health and safety. Then one level up from that, the second chakra is usually misinterpreted as sexuality. It's really not. It's more generally about pleasure. The second basic need is pleasure. Why is pleasure so important? And that Maslow missed that one because we were so academic and serious in the 1950s and 60s that we didn't even think pleasure is frivolous. But it's not frivolous. Pleasure is the things that we have evolved to find pleasurable are the things that support our lives in general. We like the taste of an orange because it's good for us. We don't like the taste of orange juice because it has too much fructose, but that's a whole other story. You can't eat anything anymore. You have to be a breatharian. Everything. You know what I'm saying, those of you who follow nutrition. It's like, oh my God, you can't do that. Anyway. All right, back to the second chakra, the second basic need, pleasure. Even a one-celled animal, a paramecium, goes toward food and away from poison. Plants grow toward the sun, toward nutrients and away from noxious influences. If you can't respond to pleasure and move toward it, you don't get life support. Now there are pleasures that are life denying. They're addictions. They're things that have been that are not good for you. So you can't go. You have to use your head about what is pleasurable and healthy and what is pleasurable and unhealthy. But in general, pleasure leads you toward things that increase your life. And so it's really important to have pleasure in life. If you had everything else and you had no pleasure, you'd get seriously depressed. Pleasure is important. It must be built into the life, you know, and paid attention to. That's the second level. And if you don't have enough pleasure, that's going to interfere with your functioning and with your meditations, with your further development. Third level, third basic need. I put it here, solar plexus in this area, the need for identity. The need to know who you are, have a clear sense of yourself, and have other people have a clear sense of who you are and respect who you are. Why do you I talked about this just a little bit. Why do you think kids tag? What do they tag with? They don't make, I wish they made beautiful pictures, but they don't. What do they put up there? Their names. Why?
It's dog piss.
What?
It's dog piss. It's dogs marking their territory.
It's partly, no, I think it's secondarily dog piss. It's secondarily dogs marking their territory. That is, used to be gangs. I'm here and I'm here. But I know a lot of taggers who have nothing to do with gangs. They put their name up there because there's 7 billion people in the world, they're nobody at school, they're nobody anywhere else, and if they can put their name up real big on the freeway, I've noticed, you know, remember when Jesse Jackson...
That's what dogs do when they mark...
Yeah, to be noticed.
That's the same
idea. Yeah, it's not just territory, it's to be noticed.
Yeah.
Remember,
I call it dog piss as opposed to graffiti, because graffiti has some higher meaning.
I'm not going to go there. Okay. Jesse Jackson, I don't remember when it was, but I remember that he filled the L.A. Coliseum with people at one point, and he had everybody, 100,000 people, chanting, "I am somebody. I am somebody." Because people, minorities, feel like they're invisible. Ralph Ellison wrote a great book called The Invisible Man. Black is even seen, you know. The need for identity is really important. A lot of couples get into difficulty because one person says, "You don't see me. You don't understand that I'm different than you. That I have. You don't let me be myself." You know. So the need for identity, I think, is very basic. And if you don't know who you are, there's a lot of confusion about it. And if you feel like you can't be who you are in your life roles, that's going to come up over and over again and give you a lot of trouble. If you're in your work, for example, you have to be other than who you really are. You really can't show yourself at work. I don't care how much they pay you. It's costing you more than it's gaining you. Okay. Fourth level, fourth basic need is the need for connection. We're not alone. We have evolved to be connected intimately to other people. And if you don't have intimate connection, if you don't have real, meaningful, deep connection with other people, that's going to come up over and over again in your life and stop your further growth. So all four of those basic needs need to be, if you don't want to keep seeing a dark cloud and walking around in a dark cloud, those needs need to be addressed. You need to find out how to satisfy those needs. And if you ever aren't feeling good at any point, ask yourself, what need is not being satisfied now? Right? For example, if you feel really bad, what need is being said? I'm hungry. That's health and safety. Okay, go get some food, you feel better. Simple as that. So that's the unification of mindfulness and psychotherapy. It's really a question of taking care of yourself and of transcending yourself. It's not a question of just transcending yourself, of forgetting about yourself, and it's not a question of just working on yourself. It's a question of both these things happening. Next topic. How many people saw Rupert Sheldrake on Monday night? I noticed a lot of you there. That's good. I want to follow it up just a little bit. Okay. If you didn't see Rupert Sheldrake, there are two possibilities. One, we're going to put the lecture on the CLL website so you can see it. The other thing is that you can just go to YouTube, Google Rupert Sheldrake, and you can see very similar lectures that he has given. You can also see the band TED Talk, which is, we saw here, is really good. I want to make two comments about Rupert Sheldrake, and then I will see what your comments are or about Rupert Sheldrake or anything I've said so far. First, on a personal level, and some of you picked this up even from the audience, I just emailed him and thanked him. And I said, you enlightened us by your words and by your presence. Because from the time I went and got him at the Arlington Tavern at 5:30 to go do the, at 6:15 to go do the meet and greet, to the time that I walked him back to the Upham Hotel at about 10:15 at night, I watched that guy give total attention to whoever he was talking to in an open, he didn't have any kind of pretense of being better than everybody else. He just looked at you, he listened to you, he answered your question clearly. He was calm, he was patient, he didn't lose energy, he never blurted out, he never got impatient, he just kind of like, and he gave his lecture and he could have talked for 3 hours. He was just talking to you, as much time as he had. He said, oh good, I have an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half, I could give you a little more, He would have given you the whole Morphic Fields too if he had a chance to, And I thought, this guy's like the Dalai Lama. They say that the Dalai Lama, he stops and talks to somebody, you have to pull him on because he's just talking to whoever he's talking to with complete focus, complete presence. I don't know if that's true, but in my experience with him that night, that was true. And I thought, it's good to be in the presence of somebody who's that present.
And the sense of humor.
What? Yeah, I mean, he was a lovely guy, and a good heart. Obviously a good heart. There was no shtick. He was just telling you what he has believed to be true and has investigated. Really lovely. Anyway, but the second thing is he talked about extended minds. He talked about the experience that many of us have had of being stared at, and unless we're paranoid, we don't turn around habitually, but when somebody's staring at us, all right, I'm going to tell you a bad story. If you tell this, I'm going to come after you, okay? I wanted to test this out on Tuesday night, so when I got out of my class at City College about 9:15, I was walking up on City College, a pathway to the parking lot, and a young woman came and walked, maybe 10 feet in front of me, and there were a lot of other people walking. It wasn't like a threatening situation. She was just walking, and I thought, I'm going to stare at her just to test it, okay? And you know what she did? And she wasn't on her cell phone, I think, but she was like walking like this. Like this, and make sure her shirt was tucked in. How that is? And it was, and she didn't do it randomly, and I watched her, and she didn't do it later as she was walking. She did it because she felt that somebody was looking at her back, or whatever. And she tucked her shirt in. And I thought it worked. I know that's anecdotal evidence, but do you understand what most of us have had the feeling of somebody staring at us and we turn around and so that's the first thing he said. And then he talked about dogs who know when their owners are coming home and the fact that pets seem to be particularly good at this, and many of us have observed this. And then he talked about the phone phenomenon, which I think many of us have experienced. You know who's calling. And you're right a lot more than you're wrong. It isn't like chance and you forget the 99 times you're wrong. It's like you're pretty good at it sometimes. And then he also talked about the idea that, which I don't agree with, but I could be persuaded, that when you're seeing me, the neuroscience explanation is there's a virtual reality in your head, and everything you're seeing is inside your own skull. It's a reconstruction of what's out there inside your own skull. And he said he doesn't believe it's true. He believes you bring the information in, you construct it in your brain, and then you project it out to where it is. So when I'm seeing Michael, I'm projecting Michael back out to where he is. And that's why you can feel somebody staring at you, because there's a projection happening. I think there's another explanation, which I'm going to tell you in a minute. But that was it's a provocative idea. And then he talked about morphic fields. Last thing I remember he talked about is morphic fields. He said basically we've never found memories. We hypothesize that memory is a network of connections in your brain. And there's an almost infinite number of connections that can be made. There's a lot of memory that can be stored, but we don't exactly know how it works. He said maybe memory isn't inside, maybe memory is outside in a morphic field, and you draw from that morphic field when you bring the memory back in, and that might explain why when you train rats to run a maze in California, and you look in England on the same kind of rat, the same maze, they supposedly learn it more quickly. Because there's a morphic field. All right, I want to comment a little. So that's a summary of what I got. I want to comment a little bit about an alternative explanation for why these psychic abilities seem to happen, and why, even though he gets wildly significant results of his experiments, which are hotly debated in terms of his methodology, by the way. When serious researchers who don't believe in it bring people, psychics, into the laboratory or test telepathy, they don't get very good results. Institute of Noetic Sciences gets results, but they do so many tests that they get statistical significance. They aren't strong results, but they're strong only because they had so many data points. So in the laboratory, psychic abilities don't stand up well, if at all. Why? Why doesn't it work in the lab when it works for you and me? And most of us are convinced that we're not crazy, that these things actually kind of do exist. You know, mothers, you know, when they know their kids are in trouble, they know their kids are in trouble. It's not like they're paranoid about their kids all the time. They worry about their kids a lot, for sure. But they really know, you know. So why does it vanish in the laboratory? Here's why I think. When you bring a psychic or me into the laboratory and you say, can you read his mind? Or do you know who's going to call? I have to establish myself as me trying to contact her. I have to self myself and contact another self. What all these psychic abilities are about is that we're not separate. We're one mind. They're at some level. We're at the source level, whatever. There's one intelligence that gives rise to the whole deal. That's what spirituality says, right? I mean, there's some creative force. There's some universal mind. There's some unity that gives rise to all the multiplicity. Well, when I'm sleeping, when I'm not lost in myself, then I'm much more in touch with the unitive aspect, and so I'm much more psychic. When I'm trying in a laboratory or otherwise to be psychic, I have to say, I am trying to get you, that self's me, that makes you a separate person, and now I'm in the realm of duality. It doesn't work in duality. Duh. All right, so let's talk a little bit about that. Let's see. Robert, and loud or microphone?
I'd be loud. I agree with that totally. There's another way of looking at it also. You remember there was a guy named Tim Galway that talked about the Zen of tennis?
Yes.
And when athletically you get into this flow state of mind, and you're just out of your mind, and things work on a much higher level of performance than they usually do. And he said, when you're ever playing a person competitively, like I did at one point, playing tennis and somebody just playing beyond themselves, you get them to talk about themselves, some self-talk going, say, you really know why you're playing so good today?
It's really
so much better. And then you start to question it, they develop this ego state, and then they just fall apart.
Let me just talk a tiny bit about flow, and then I'll call you Iris. So, as long as I'm covering everything, the question keeps coming up. In the Eastern way to happiness is you come to this inner expansiveness, this inner peace. The Western way to happiness, as defined at this point most compellingly by positive psychologists, is you go into flow. You connect completely with something. You move, you forget about yourself. You go completely into the sport you're playing, or into a conversation you're having, or into the artwork you're creating. And hour goes by and you don't even know you're there. It's not pleasant. It's you're absorbed completely. So in the East, they say absorption bad. You don't want to be absorbed. You want to be non-absorbed, non-attached. In the West, they say you want to be completely absorbed. Who's right? They're both right. Here's another unification. It turns out that, I've talked about this before a little bit, I just want to remind you, the mushy middle is where we all get in trouble. Your personality is your home. It's a lovely place. You want to make it nice. You want to fix what's wrong. You want to do psychotherapy. You want your personality to be a good home. Just don't stay home too much. Okay? Those are the people that get in trouble, is the people that are locked in themselves for various reasons. The two strategies, the two ways for being happier, getting out of yourself, are the Eastern way, you go interior to yourself. There's Spence. There's whomever. You know, you're the awareness of who you were before you sat down to meditate. So if you go inside, there's no problem. The problem is in the self. The problem isn't in the awareness. The awareness is just awareness. If it has, the Hindus say it has three properties, Sat Chit Ananda, it's always there, it's always aware, and it's always peaceful or blissful, depending on how you translate Ananda. Those are the only properties of awareness. Everything, the trouble is in the self. So you can do the Eastern way and step back. Many of us are practicing that, but for a lot of people in the West, that's hard. You know, mindfulness will not everybody will be able to do mindfulness at the level we're doing. The other way is you get out of yourself. Feel depressed? Go. Get outside, even though you don't want to. Go where you have to interact with other people. It's an old saw in psychology that unless a person is really severely depressed, their depression vanishes when they're talking to somebody else that they're interested in or doing something else that they like. The minute that I remember when one time I was depressed, I would give a class, and for 3 hours I would, no depression, no me. I'm so in flow in class. And I would walk out the door, and it was like, it hit me like a brick as I came back to myself. So the other way out of feeling bad, of difficulty, of being happier, is get out, find something that absorbs you. That's called flow. Right, Iris. Iris.
Well, yes, being decided, if I have to analyze something, I can't. So that's why when people say, can you do this or can you do that? It's like I shut down. And I don't plan it, it just happens.
Right, but when you're walking around, all kinds of things.
Yeah, I can just look at somebody here and know all about them. but I can't.
And
somebody says, what do you know about
them? And then, right, because they,
yeah.
Thank you.
I have to analyze.
Thank you for, right, the analysis function takes it away. So, I remember, I put something down, okay. Who is best, I have a couple more, I knew there were a couple more things. Who is best at this telepathy and other stuff, like, the psychic stuff, the paranormal stuff? Mothers and children? Because they're unified. They have a unified field. They're not entirely separate. No matter how many years go by, no matter if death happens. mothers, there's a field. You started unified with your mother, and at some level, you're always going to be unified with your mother. So they get they're the ones that, you know, they know their kid is in trouble all the way across the or all across the earth. You know, kids are all psychic. Until we learn you can't do it, you can do it. I mean, because kids don't have enough of a self to kind of block, get in the way. Kids are super intuitive. They're, you know, but they don't, as far as I know, they don't do the experiments on four-year-olds or three-year-olds. They really should. They'll do much better than us. Who else is good at these unified kind of things? Family, friends, and lovers. People that you're connected with at a deep level, they're the ones that you, unless you start to, you know, self, they're the ones that have the easiest access to you. They're the most unified with you. There is a phenomenon in physics called Bell's theorem, in quantum physics. If you take two electrons that have been generated together, and you flip one of them over, and you take two electrons that have been generated together, so they're paired somehow. They've come up together. They come into existence together. And by the way, I think it's probably other particles and electrons. I'm just using electrons because I don't know that you generate electrons. But anyway, here are these two particles that have been generated. Elementary particles that have been generated together. If you could move them very far apart, then if you flipped one of them over, the other one would instantly flip over. There wouldn't have to be a signal at 186,000 miles a second going between one particle and the other. It would be instant communication, no matter if they were at opposite ends of the universe.
That's not right.
Quantum entanglement.
I know, but what you said is not right. If you want to take time another time, I could say what's right.
Okay, so he'll correct me. The point is that there's something called quantum entanglement, which means that two particles don't have to communicate in a normal way. They're always connected. So Dean Radin of the Institute of Noetic Sciences wrote a book called Entangled Minds, in which he said that these psychic phenomena are larger example of entanglement. So they aren't with elementary particles, they're with us. But it's the same idea. If you're connected to somebody, that there's a channel of communication that isn't a normal physical channel of communication.
That's what Rupert said. There's a resonance.
Yeah, he calls it a morphic resonance. So let's see what other people want to say about anything that we've said this evening. Today. I teach a lot at night. Okay, Michael.
It just struck me that, as was mentioned earlier, breaking the flow during a game, say a tennis, can destroy your game. It seems like there might be something like that calling... When we can heal ourselves and we become aware of it, and then that breaks the flow of healing. So we, what is it called again? Placebo effect. The power comes from when you're not knowing that it's fake. If you believe it's working, then you're in the flow of belief and you heal. If you know that it's not, it doesn't help. It just seems like there's a similarity.
Okay, so I want to take off tangentially to that about healing. Various kinds of healers, many of you practice this. There's two strategies that healers have. One strategy is I heal you. Okay. That strategy seems to be less effective than I don't heal you. I go into a state of unity, a state of enlightenment, and in the presence of my state of enlightenment, you heal. So when the person is doing energy work with you, they're not zapping energy into you. Some people are, I guess, but I think most of I've heard a lot of healers that I really respect say, I don't try to heal that person, I don't inject them with energy, What I do is I find my own peaceful, open center. And I just stay with them in that peaceful, open state. And that creates a resonance in them, if you will, or a, their center opens up also, or they heal because of their contact, their unity with my healing. That makes sense to people? That it's not a question of me and you. It's a question of getting into a unitive state and the consequences of that state. Let's see, other, maybe one more comment. Oh, I want to make a, before, well, I want to make a statement and then make one more comment. The statement is, we do very varied things on different weeks. Next week, I'm going to show you two sensational short videos as part of the class. Okay, so last comment.
I think I could explain the bells thing more accurately. Okay, so.
Loud.
Yeah. So, what you said about Bell's theorem and entanglement is approximate. What you said about
closer.
Bell's theorem and entanglement is approximately correct in that there's some other form of communication that we don't understand. But there is an important detail that is not what you said. So what Spencer said is that you have these two particles and they're entangled with each other and that you flip one and the other one flips. That is not correct. Okay, so what is correct is you probably know like Polaroid sunglasses, right? If the light is aligned with the polarization of the glass, it goes through. If it's perpendicular to the polarization of the glass, it doesn't go through. However, in between those two extremes, there's a probability of the photon going through the glass. So that is where entanglement happens, is in that probabilistic range. So the thing is that relativity is still true, and so you can't flip something and send a signal because that would violate relativity. What is true is that if you send a photon through this polarizing lens at, let's say, at 45 degree angle, there's a 50% chance of going through. Then if the one over here goes through, then the one over there will do the opposite, okay?
Yeah.
Right, but it's statistical. So you can't know in advance whether it's going to go through. That's an important distinction because that's what saves relativity, it's what saves causality.
Yeah.
The idea that if A causes B, then A had to come before B.
Got it. That's okay.
That's a small but important
No, that's a really important point. Okay, so thank you. That's that for me, that was an important point. Okay, okay, we're adjourned for the day. If you want to bring